thank you very much, Valentina. It was very, very clear and very interesting. I'm very happy to be there today to have the occasion to comment your work. Mm-hmm. I'm not a specialist of this field of research, but I worked for many years on family separations through marital breakdown and child custody issues. So I will go through these issues that I am aware of, and then I will let the audience comment your work and ask their questions. Yes, I can underline many links between transnational child care relationships and non-residential parents' relationship with their children after divorce. Of course, this is not the same configuration in your case. You study long-distance relationship between one or two parents with their kids, and in my research, parents are rarely this far from mm-hmm. their children, except on the very specific case regarding international children kidnapping. But it's quite rare actually. But many topics are also very, very similar. First, the question of the child well-being, mm-hmm. which is a recurring issue which has been widely developed in divorce studies by very well-known sociologists as Amato, Keith, Booth, Furstenberg, etc. All this literature about divorce consequences has also raised the question of the adult well-being after having experienced a divorce in their childhood. So I was wondering whether you have been able or not to explore this question among adults that have experienced transnational relationship in their childhood, and how it impacts their current relationship with their parents, but also with their kids. So to sum up, there is transmission of migration when you create your own family. Secondly, the question of finances, you didn't really talk about it in your presentation, but in your article it was quite interesting to see that through transnational child care, you have this issue of financial of when you give money to your child caregiver. Mm-hmm. And it is very familiar to me when you study child custody issue. It's quite common. And lots of anthropologists in France, like Agnès Martial, or in Quebec, Hélène Bello, have developed in their work the emotional dimension of money, and especially when it is dissociated from amorous feelings, etc. I have noticed in one of your articles that the parents' feeling when they give money to the child giver is quite the same from a non-residential father paying the alimony for their kids to their ex-wives. Mm-hmm. They have the same fear, which is seeing their money wasted and not properly used for their children. And you also detail the way child caregivers use that money, and especially when the parents do not deposit the month's account. So this description can also be easily assimilated with non-payment of the alimony, which is quite recurring in the literature of divorce. So I was I had a question about your qualitative methodology with children. You talk about it a little bit, so I was wondering how it was working into interviewing children. Do you have a minimum age? Do you have methodological reflection about this issue? And is it difficult to interview children? And do you have a special modus operandi which is quite different from adult interviews? I just have one final question. You were talking about. When I was just wondering, is there sometimes an arrangement between the parents, the migrant parents, and their children? Is it plain that the children will always stay in their country, or is it plain that the children will eventually join the parents in Netherlands or in Ireland? I don't know. And you talk about Ireland, and you say it is there is a law issue between Nigeria and Ireland. I just wanted to know what was this law issue.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm done. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I don't know if we can take some.
Maybe you can react to that, and then we add other elements to the
discussion. Sure. Okay. Good. Well, first of all, thank you for your comments, and I'm really, really happy with your drawing analogies with a completely different body of literature, because that's actually exactly what we try to do also with this project. Because one thing that you notice is that a lot of the times research on migration gets published in journals on migration. And so we call it preaching to the choir, right? So it's like the preacher who turns around and they have the whole choir behind, and you're just telling the choir rather than telling the other people what about God. And I think that migrant families are a case that one can study in order to know something much more general about families, and vice versa, something that is known about divorced families, for example, should be investigated in migrant families. And I think that's so important also to get out of our, you know, focusing on migrants as some exception or something so different. And that's why I was actually really happy. So you see the first two, the bottom two articles are typical publications on migration, but the top one is actually does not publish on migration in particular, and it's definitely not one not even a major theme in that in that journal. So the fact that we actually were able to publish in that journal was a huge conquest for us. You know, it was like reaching the top of the mountain, precisely because of these analogies that you're making. So. But then you having made this analogy with the, you know, things like alimony or divorce and separation, then you asked the very, I think, important question is there a transmission of these migration effects over time? And I think that one of the main ways to go forward with migration research is to do more longitudinal work, because we only work with snapshots. Even these are all snapshots. And what I've showed you here, you know, that's what it was like at the time of research. And who knows what it'll be when these kids are old. And we just don't, because the data that, first of all, there's no data collected on transnational families, which already is telling. That's because statistical offices that normally collect data are not thinking transnationally, they're thinking nationally. So we just don't know how many transnational families there are, although we have an indication that they might be really much larger than we think. So that's, I think that's the avenue for the future, is looking at that. But the only small thing that I could say is that and that we found very interesting is that 30% of the parents that we interviewed in the European countries had actually been fostered themselves when they were children.
Okay.
So what, you know, what does this tell us? I think it cannot say anything about effects or anything like that, but it, I think it made stronger the argument that coming from a normative context of child fostering, you will not think it so strange to leave your child with your mother if you're going to migrate.
Mm-hmm.
And you won't, you don't even think that you're doing your child something bad. In fact, you think you're doing something very good for your child because your mother is a very good caregiver. You trust your mother. You know she can do a good job. Plus, you're going overseas and you can send money. So you're doing it, you know, you're just being a wonderful parent, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was an interesting, yes, you know, descriptive thing that 30% of the parents had actually been fostered themselves. Let's see, the emotional dimensions of money, I think that's, and that they can also be sources of tensions. I think that's, that was more of a comment that you made, not
no,
a question.
It was
and
a
I
comment.
Think it's very
yeah.
well taken and indeed. But I think also what's, you know, for example, the comments at the very beginning, the very first one about, he buys me things, my dad buys me things, right? But that also has to do with sort of normative ideas of, who is a good parent? What does a good parent do? And a good father and a good mother provide for you. They provide, you know, in the African context, it's the people who can give you food to eat. And it's the people who can give you a school uniform so that you can go to school. And it's the people who pay your school fees in a context where school fees are very high. So there's already a lot of, you know, the emotional side of money. Being able to eat, being able to be clothed, so I think it's too easy to say that then migration leads to a commodification of care. Mm. I actually think it's just a propagation of this context of what does a good parent do. So that's why I think it's a very important point, and one that, again, and I'm sorry to Rachel Pareñas because I keep mentioning her work. but she's also always, you know, mentioning the commodification of care, and so everything's now about money and.
Who is senator?
But I think, I think it needs to be seen within a local context. Interview children. It was extremely difficult. But also the interviews that you saw at the beginning were just one-off interviews. At first we read all the children literature and we said, oh, okay, we'll get nice magic markers and we'll have them draw and do this. And these poor kids, they were just looking at us like, what do these adults want? They want to play with us? You know, so they were so confused and they felt so they felt so gêné. Awkward. That we decided, okay, let's just go back to this.
Where was it?
This is in Ghana.
No, but where it was in school?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it was after school, but in school. And the reason why we chose that context was because we felt that would be a good place where maybe the adult wouldn't be so inclined to then come in.
Yeah.
And also it's a trusted context because it's a school where the child goes every day. The schools were very accommodating and they allowed us, you know, they said you can take one of our classrooms after school when they're empty. And so we did it in a classroom context and we did it one by one. So one interviewer, one child being interviewed. Local interviewer. And and the age range was indeed, you know, from this 11 to 21, but actually the better interviews and the ones that we could use more was more from, let's say, 15, 16 to 21. Then those were the ones. I mean, I did have a couple of, or one was a 12-year-old, but most of the interviews were older kids.
Because when they were younger, so
it's hard to get them to talk.
Yeah.
You know, to get
They do not develop their feelings or they do not.
Yeah, no, I think it's more that it's just so awkward to speak to a foreign or, you know, someone you don't know, an adult. And yeah. It's also a culture where you don't speak your feelings to adults. Mm. If you do that much more readily to your age mates. So, but for this one-off interviews, it was okay. What was much more difficult was trying to do the ethnographic studies and hanging out and that was just very difficult, and we had, in a way, naively underestimated that we could do all of these things. So in the end, we actually focused much more on, in the ethnographic work, we focused much more on the caregiver, so the person taking care mm-hmm. of the child, and then on the parents in the mm-hmm. European context. So that's my new project, actually. Is now I'm focusing on the children, and okay. only the children. So maybe you can invite me here again in 3 years.